Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Sarah Stockwell about her study of the changes in the role British institutions played in their country's former empire during the period of decolonization, entitled The British End of the British Empire. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
I'm a historian of the British Empire and specifically of British imperialism and colonialism in the 20th century and mostly the second half of the 20th century. So my research has focused above all on British decolonisation. I started out by looking at the experience of British business during decolonisation in Ghana, West Africa. And since then, I've worked on a variety of different aspects of British decolonisation, including most recently, but not featured in the book that we're discussing, looking at the Church of England and the end of empire. I suppose generally I focus more on sort of economic aspects of decolonisation than other. I edited a general history of the British Empire called The British Empire, Themes and Perspectives. I've also worked on one of the volumes in the British Empire, British Documents on the End of Empire series. And I've spent nearly all my career at King's College London, where I'm currently Professor of Imperial and Commonwealth History.
When I have thought about British decolonization in the past, I've always thought it from the standpoint of the political, governmental relations with that decline. And one of the things that I find fascinating about the approach to decolonization in your work is the fact that you don't look at it just from that official governmental perspective, but you're looking at all these other aspects of British institutions and British organizations that were involved in the empire. And that brings us to the book that you've written, which looks at these roles that these institutions were playing at the point when decolonization starts and as it is proceeding. What was it that led you to write this particular book and to focus upon the institutions that you did?
So I suppose throughout my entire academic career, I've had an interest in decolonization beyond the state quite narrowly defined here as a sort of Westminster and Whitehall policymaking centre. As I said at the start, I began my career doing a doctorate on British business and decolonization. At that point, so this was the late 1980s, the early 1990s, there was a considerable body of work on the end of empire emerging, but it was principally to do with the state and perhaps sort of crudely put to do with explaining why and how the end of empire occurred and to do with imperial policy making and how the British managed the various pressures they were facing, whether those be in the form of anti-colonial nationalism or the sort of international pressures at the time, and less to do with how decolonization impacted on individuals and organizations, either on the margins of the state or beyond. And so starting with my PhD, I developed this interest in looking at decolonization from sort of a non-state perspective. And I've maintained that ever since. In the years since I did my PhD and started work on business and decolonization, the historiography on decolonization has expanded hugely. And there's been a very considerable interest in the ways in which decolonization shaped British society and culture, particularly around debates around things like immigration to Britain in the 50s and the 60s. But I think there's still been a lack of attention paid to sort of institutions sort of in the middle between the state, narrowly defined, and individuals and society and the sort of cultural aspects of decolonization. And that's a gap that I hope to go some way towards filling in my book by looking at these different institutions. I suppose my second motivation was that I've always been interested in processes of state building below the level of parliamentary democracies. I've taught decolonization for very many years at King's in London. And one of the things I've always been interested in is the development of institutions below that of parliamentary ones in emergent states. And it's something that I think rarely figures at all in the broader literature on decolonization. Instead, analysis and discussion of institution building has really been confined to quite specialist literatures that are about particular sectors. So issues to do with the military, for instance, in a literature dominated by military specialists, or to do with building financial institutions in a literature that's led by financial historians, but largely addressed to other financial historians rather than to historians of empire more generally. And I hoped in this book to engage with processes of institution building across different sectors and to bring evidence and material relating to building institutions and the British role in the development of building institutions in new states below the level of parliamentary democracies. I wanted to bring those in sort of dialogue with one another so that there was a study that looked at, for example, institution building in relation to public administration alongside the development of institutions in the financial sector and military institutions.
Your examination of the building of those institutions was, I thought, really fascinating because, as you describe in the initial chapter of your book, these British institutions are not just building institutions out of a sense of altruism. They're not saying, well, you know, they have a military, so we must train the military. They're doing so with their own agendas, ones that sometimes are, of course, very complementary with the British state, but also ones that are sometimes designed to play to the particular needs of the institution at home as well. I'm thinking, for example, of like the Bank of England issues with sterling balances in the 1950s and 1960s. I was wondering if you could perhaps begin our discussion of the book itself by talking about overall the overarching approach of institution building during that period of decolonization that you address in your book.
Okay. My sort of starting point in the book is that a variety of different domestic British institutions had, to varying degrees, and there are obviously differences between institutions, over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, assumed kind of imperial roles or in different ways become participants in Britain's imperial project. And sort of more than this, I argue that the nature of the liberal British state was such that institutions on the borders of the state, even when they were technically under the control of the state, as for example, one of my institutions, the Mint is, it's under the control of the Treasury or the Bank of England, which was nationalised in 1946. They're technically under the control of the state, and yet they enjoyed considerable autonomy and were effectively and able to exercise their own agency in what I describe as a very pluralistic British political system. And within that pluralistic system, these institutions that had assumed some form of imperial role exercised their own agency at the end of empire in ways that one could argue amounted to a form of imperialism, as they sought to promote and protect their own distinct institutional interests, as well as sort of broader strategic and commercial British interests at the end of empire. Does that answer that question, Mark?
It does. And it was something that I thought was, you know, kind of interesting how you put both of those into play. It wasn't just these institutions as institutions, but also as representatives of the British, I don't want to say state, but sort of the British interest overall, which is, it was interesting getting into the, how you sometimes quote from these individuals and how they're thinking of themselves, not just as the individuals in this role or as representatives of, say, the Mint or of, say, Sanders, but also of how they were very cognizant of that role that they played as, you know, people that were British actors playing this important role representing Britain in this process.
Yes. So I think they have a broad sense of the importance of promoting British strategic and commercial objectives, particularly strategic in the context of the Cold War, and in a very general sense of maintaining British influence in former British colonies in the post-colonial era. But they each have their quite distinct objectives, and they use some of the opportunities that are presented by decolonization to promote those. And one of the things I argue in the book is that these imperial roles that had evolved over a long period of time in the 19th and the 20th century, in some ways, they reach a sort of peak in the period immediately after or around the Second World War. So that in what is the sort of twilight phase of the British Empire, domestic institutions had, and obviously this is a bit of a generalization across different institutions, but very sort of broadly speaking, those institutions, their interest and stake in the empire was of enhanced importance around the mid 20th century rather than of sort of dwindling importance. So just at the point at which Britain was on the cusp of losing the empire, they have this particular vested interest in their roles. The Mint is one example of that. The Mint's imperial role, as it evolved in the course of the 19th century, entailed the production of coin for various British colonies, as well as for some foreign countries. It had also overseen the development of branch mints in Australia and Canada and South Africa. Now, that export business was important to the Mint because although the Mint's core business remained the production of coin for Britain, there are always periods when British demand was slack, and export business allowed the Mint to continue using its staff and its plant during those periods of slack demand and indeed of generating a profit. And in the course of the 20th century, the Mint's export business expanded, and it was the business of supplying coin to the colonies and the dominions that was above all of importance to the Mint. And in the 20th century, the British government established various colonial currency boards that issued currencies for different parts of the empire. So, for instance, there was a West African currency board and an East African currency board, and the mint supplied all the coin to those currency boards. And the colonies were, in effect, through the arrangements of the currency boards, tied customers of the mint. That is, they had no choice in where they placed the orders for the their currencies. And this export business really peaked in the early 1950s. In 1952, which was a really important year in terms of sort of export production, the mints, over 90% of what the mint produced was for export. And 2/3 of that export business was destined for the Empire and Commonwealth. And so just as the mint's business, export business was peaking, with the Empire Commonwealth constituting a very important part of that, there was the prospect of political change leading to self-government and independence, and the prospect that these tied colonial customers would be able to source their coins from elsewhere. And so, you know, in the mint's case, there was this strong vested interest in trying to preserve those existing arrangements. And for quite different reasons, the Empire Commonwealth was of very considerable significance to the Bank of England at the same point in the mid-20th century. The bank had long had an international role through its management of sterling as an international currency. But after Britain left the gold standard in 1931, and other countries, particularly the colonies and the dominions, with the exception of Canada, chose to base their currencies on sterling and maintain a fixed exchange rate to sterling, these countries formed a kind of loose association known as the Sterling Bloc. And this increased the importance, really, of the Empire Commonwealth to the Bank of England. And that only intensified with the outbreak of the Second World War, because at that point, the imposition of exchange control throughout the British Empire transformed this kind of loose association of countries basing their currencies on sterling into a very tightly regulated sterling area that was managed by the Bank of England, in which sterling reserves of different parts of the sterling area were sort of pooled in London and were available to the British government to use. In effect, they were giving loans to the British government. And the bank had also developed very close relations with new central banks in the Dominions. Indeed, it had played a role in the formation of many of those. And in the Second World War, it became it began to be represented on every single colonial currency board. So its role in the empire was certainly not diminishing in this period leading up to the end of empire. And one could argue something similar, but for different reasons, for the universities of Oxford and Cambridge as well, two of the other institutions on which I focus. In their case, the imperial role that I concentrate on is their part in delivering colonial service training. They've done that since the 1920s. There's a hiatus in colonial service training during the Second World War. But after the war, the British government introduces a new and enhanced colonial service training programme that corresponded to a kind of revitalised sense of British imperial purpose, at least as it related to those parts of the empire that remained after South Asian independence. And participating in this enhanced training regime brought benefits to Oxford and Cambridge, as well as to the University of London, which was also a participant in this this training. in part in terms of prestige for the institutions, but more particularly in terms of material benefits, because the Colonial Office paid them to deliver the training, and that financed lectureships and research and institutes in areas related to the Empire and Commonwealth. So again, there's an institution that in the mid 20th century, as I say, in the sort of cusp of you know, decolonization, has this, or at least it, some of the individuals within it, have a significant vested interest in the empire. They'd all become, I argue, to varying degrees and in different ways, stakeholders in the British Empire.
I thought that point you made in your book about the ways in which the colleges were benefiting financially from their role in providing training for the colonial service to be an interesting one, because it gets to how, when it made me think about how they might have approached, how they must have approached it, which was they were not thinking in terms of, well, here we are training people to engage in decolonization, or here we are, as you talk about later on, bringing in people from the colonies to train them for their own development of a civil service. But they're thinking in terms of, well, we're getting this amount of money from the state, so and this helps our budget in this way. It just struck me that how what you're talking about here is so important. And yet at the same time, you can see in it the traces for which it was not necessarily about this grand strategy that's plotted out in 1947 or 1948 about how decolonization is to be achieved, but through these mundane aspects of these institutions, which are themselves dealing with these very immediate concerns that are turning them towards the empire, the creation of chairs in tropical medicine, the appeal for, and as you describe, the oftentimes quarreling that takes place between the colleges over who's going to get various grants from the state to maintain colonial service training.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Now, I think there's two aspects to it. I think during the Second World War, there are key figures in the institutions who are very closely involved in the discussions about in the universities, I should say. So this is just with reference to Oxford and Cambridge, who are key figures in the discussions about reforming colonial service training. And they are absolutely clear that it's crucial that universities continue to be the key providers of colonial service training. And that is in part because they themselves come out of a system in which the sort of what's perceived to be the kind of best training for entry to the civil service is not any kind of vocational or professional training in the way in which is the case in some European countries, for instance. Instead, they very much believe that the best education for those entering the civil service, any civil service, is a kind of liberal education that sort of produces the generalist, the gentlemanly generalist, and that it's institutions like Oxford and Cambridge that are best placed to provide that kind of training. And at the same time, there is, in the 1940s, still a very strong sense of the value of the British Empire amongst some of these individuals, and that it's important to the prestige of the institutions that they continue to be involved in providing this training. But there are also a core group of academics who are the beneficiaries of Colonial Office funding. And like academics anywhere, they compete for that money and for the spoils of it. And as time goes on, I mean, into the 1950s and 1960s, and as the sort of climate changes and there is much less sense that that participating in these kind of courses is important to the prestige of the universities as a whole, there are still these small groups who will continue to fight for this money, because bottom line, their jobs are involved. And when the funding's withdrawn, in some cases, they lose their jobs.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that's one of the reasons why I found that to be so important in terms of the story about how the training evolves over the in the universities over the course of time that you examine. Again, I was struck by the photographs that you provided in the book of three different classes of trainees for Colonial Administrative Service, and how their complexion changes over time as they go from training Britons to go out and govern the empire to we're now bringing in people from Africa to train them in preparation for that transition that is coming up, where we're coming in to train them as they're now getting their own services off the ground and they have yet to develop their own institutional memories or training programs of their own. So we're going to continue to train them, and how these endured into the 1970s and continue to play this very vital role, which is very different from the role that you described that they were created to do in the 1920s, 1930s.
Yes. So, I mean, this takes me into what is the third chapter of my book, which focuses simply on Oxford and Cambridge and the evolution of these training courses that had initially been intended for white entrants to the colonial service, but which evolved to become courses that recruit initially some non-white locals from different colonies, and eventually in the early 1960s are entirely tailored towards students from overseas. So there's the really, in some ways, extraordinary situation that the training program for the colonial service survives the end of empire and continues on until 1969. There are sort of descendants of the colonial service training courses taught at Oxford. In 1969, the British Ministry of Overseas Development, which has assumed responsibility for funding these courses from the Colonial Office, withdraws its funding from Oxford, but it continues to give funding to Cambridge for these courses until 1981, when Thatcher's government makes cuts to Britain's AIDS budget and Cambridge loses its funding for these courses at that point. And the content of the courses had evolved over the course of the 1960s and, in Cambridge's case, the 1970s. In particular, the course at Cambridge became much more focused on development in the 1970s, which incidentally is one quite powerful illustration of the colonial roots of development studies. But nonetheless, they are direct descendants of these colonial service training courses, and they survive really against the odds because individuals at both institutions fight for their survival and their continuation, and they succeed for a time in persuading the British government that they should continue to fund these courses, no longer for expatriate entrants to the colonial service, but for administrators from former colonies, that the state should continue to do this as part of Britain's package of technical assistance and aid to developing countries. Obviously, only one small part of the way in which the British state, like other foreign countries and international organisations, assisted with the task of developing public administration in new states in Africa and elsewhere.
You also reference another aspect of this, which is not really a central theme, but I thought as an American was this rather amusing subtext, which is the concern about declining influence or loss of influence to the United States. And where you really see that is in your chapter on the Bank of England. And I thought that was very interesting in the sense of it, about how this wasn't just a kind of like a hermetic relationship or one's kind of sealed off between Britain and the colonies. But in this environment, you already referenced the Cold War, but they're also, you know, concerned about maintaining a role or an influence, if not a dominance, over these colonies when it comes to dealing with Western partners. And of course, you have the United States, you have the Bank of England representing the British when it comes to the finance. And then the United States, you have the Federal Reserve Board, the IMF, which is positioned in a way to usurp some of these roles. How does the Bank of England adapt to this changing dynamic? And in what ways are they attempting to maintain their presence in the colonies beyond the ones that you just described?
Well, as you say, the sort of post-Second World War international environment is very different to earlier periods, and one in which the British no longer have the edge over other powers and are unquestionably sort of subordinate to the United States. But I think initially at the Bank of England, the officials who've been sort of brought up, the ones who are in charge, who sort of come through the bank in an earlier period where they're used to being able to shape developments overseas. And I think there's a strong expectation among them in the late 1940s and the early 1950s that they should continue to be able to do so, despite Britain's diminished economic standing and despite America's dominance of the post-war world. In the bank's case, as I said earlier, they had developed this strong vested interest in the Empire Sterling area, and in particular in the the colonies' continued membership of the Sterling area and their continued use of sterling as a reserve currency and holding their reserves, etc., in sterling. The way in which political change in the colonies threatened that was because the colonies began demanding their own financial institutions, independent financial institutions, first of all, state banks, and then more particularly, central banks that would have currency issuing powers, and with it, of course, their own currencies rather than those issued by the colonial currency boards. And the Bank of England was initially resolutely opposed to this development and to any kind of financial devolution. And it set out really to obstruct the development of state and central banks in British colonies in Africa. But by about the mid-1950s, it was becoming apparent that it could no longer do that. And one of the reasons that it was becoming clear couldn't do that was because it faced some sort of pressure or the influence of both the American Federal Reserve and the World Bank in British colonies. For example, with World Bank economic missions where they recommended that there should be some steps in the direction of the development of central banks, it became hard for the Bank of England to resist that. And so at that stage, the British the Bank of England set out to exercise as much oversight as it possibly could over the process of financial devolution and the creation of new central banks in British colonies. And it did that in a variety of ways, in part by supplying, where it could, experts to advise on drawing up the constitutions for these new banks. And in that way, the Bank of England sought to ensure that they followed a British model of central banking. The Bank of England also seconded staff to work in some of them, and it instituted its own training course that ran for some weeks in London and took place every 2 years, and that was aimed particularly at or only at Commonwealth countries. And in doing that, the Bank of England sought not only to promote adherence to the sterling area and the continued use of sterling, as well as to promote the City of London and the financial services of the City of London in new states, but also to advance its own model of central banking that was distinct from that of the Federal Reserve. And so although at one level, the British and the Americans obviously shared a vested interest in maintaining sort of Western influence generally in former British colonies as they became independent and in the early post-colonial era, my research on the Bank of England highlights how, you know, particular British institutions nevertheless also had their own agendas and sought not to promote a kind of generic Western influence, but in some cases a very particular model of sort of Britishness and of British models as distinct from other Western ones.
And that was an aspect of your book that I thought was especially relevant for today, given that we still have that ongoing discussion about the continuing role of various Western nations in the affairs of their other countries. And I thought you pointed to just how, for lack of a better word, off the top of my head, insidious some of these influences were, about how sometimes they're very kind of behind the scenes and you're not necessarily aware of them, but they're by extending these cultural practices, they really help to shape that reorientation or that continuing orientation back to that that home country. Because you think about when you have a banker who undergoes his training in England in English practices, if an issue comes up or a concern comes up, to whom are they going to be most comfortable turning on the international scene? And the answer, of course, is to the people who they receive their training from in the practices that are with which they're most familiar.
I mean, I have to say, of course, that British institutions like the Bank of England that became involved in providing what we can describe as a form of technical assistance to institutions in new states obviously competed with many other sources of aid and assistance. And within former British colonies, many elites preferred to source their assistance and aid from places other than Britain. So, for example, in Ghana, which was the first of Britain's African colonies to become independent, the finance minister in Ghana was instrumental in persuading the IMF and the World Bank to develop their own sort of infrastructure for dealing with African states. Because when Ghana became independent, neither the World Bank or the IMF had a dedicated kind of Africa department. And the IMF went on to offer a whole range of different training courses and also to provide assistance in different ways. And the Bank of England's the assistance that the Bank of England provided was you know, small really in scope, but the bank certainly hoped that it would foster connections to the Bank of England, and particularly in the earliest years, when because there were so few highly trained professionals able to replace the British at the helm of different institutions in new states. Those who had, for example, attended the Oxbridge training courses or who participated in some of the Bank of England's training, there were a significant number who went on to occupy very senior positions in institutions of new states. It's not to say that in that capacity they acted in ways that were necessarily in British interests at all. But nonetheless, the connections between some of the British institutions and professionals in institutions in new states were, in other respects, quite surprisingly long-lived.
I also thought about it from another standpoint as well, which is this notion of how the British maintain a certain concept of themselves as being the highest standard. And I thought that really came across best in your chapter about the Royal Mint. And that was a chapter where it took me a while to appreciate just how important that would be. And I was thinking of it from the standpoint of how when we approach ancient history, one of the ways that we oftentimes access it and measure it is through the spread of coinage. And thinking of it that way made me realize just how something as seemingly mundane as minting coins was a very important statement of sovereignty to these countries, and how important it was as a measure of their newfound independence and their, for lack of a better word, they're deserving that independence, that they have high quality coinage that represented their country at its finest, and which made the Royal Mint, gave the Royal Mint a great argument to step in and do just that.
Yes. So I think for new states, there were certain kind of badges of independent nation statehood. Having your own independent central bank was one, and also issuing your own currency rather than that of the old colonial currency board. And again, it's another one of the huge ironies or sort of ambiguities of the decolonization process that it was the British Mint which produced most of these coins, these symbols of independent nation statehood. They also, in many cases, produced independence medals. And when some former colonies, when they became republics, so no longer with the Queen as head of state, some of them issued coins to mark that. And again, the Royal Mint was involved in producing those. And then as we sort of deeper into the post-colonial period, political instability in post-colonial states proved quite profitable for the Mint, because every time there was a regime change, there would be a new currency. And because of the established connection to the Mint, for many of them, they would turn back to the Mint to produce that new currency. So actually producing these symbols of independent statehood and some of the political changes that occurred in former colonies were really could be quite profitable for the Mint and a source of ongoing business. So I spoke at the start about how the Mint had acquired this vested interest in export business and how political change posed a risk to that, because they would lose the colonies as tied customers. But it also presented an opportunity to go out and seek this new business. And I argue that the Mint was remarkably successful at doing that, to the extent that by the 1960s, the British Royal Mint devoted more of its capacity to export than any other world mint. It had over 80% of the share of what it referred to as the available coinage market, and was supplying over 50 countries with their currencies, their metallic coins. And it was able to do that partly because new colonies seeking their own currencies, often to quite tight deadlines, would utilize the established connection to the mint. But also the mint sort of went all out to ensure that it secured the business of new states. One of the other things I argue is that because there was effectively a diaspora of British personnel in former colonies after they became independent, whether they were sort of legacy personnel from colonial administrators who were still in post, or some of those Bank of England personnel who were acting as advisors or seconded to work in new central banks, that this also facilitated the Mint's acquisition of contracts to supply new states, with the result that decolonization had almost a staggered effect. And it was only into the 1970s that the Mint began to complain that as competition for business increased, particularly in the form of the American Mint, that former colonies were only then beginning to realize that they were no longer tied to purchasing their coin from the Royal Mint.
The final institution you examine is the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. And it's an interesting one in that it's an institution that is dealing with something that has a lot of Cold War implications with the dealing and the creation of an institution that in itself in these countries has oftentimes posed a different set of challenges. And yet you explain that how the transition that takes place there as well, which is one that is, could you explain a bit perhaps that role that that Sandhurst played and how it involved a certain shift in outlook for them as well?
So I chose to look at Sandhurst because I wanted to focus on domestic institutions that were involved in what I see as three key sectors: administration, finance, and the sort of military. But Sandhurst's position was different to that of the other institutions I look at, whereas I argue that the others exercised their own agency and had their own objectives and interests that they pursued during decolonization. In Sandhurst's case, I argue that wasn't so. Instead, Sandhurst was very much that the role it played was very much dictated to it by different departments of the British government, above all the War Office. And what I argue in Sandhurst's case is that, well, Sandhurst, I perhaps should say that Sandhurst had also had an imperial role, in particular, very obviously, training British officer cadets who assume roles in the British Army and in that capacity might be overseas in one of the sort of Britain's garrisons, or they might be seconded to work with colonial forces like King's African Rifles in East Africa. But Sandhurst also trained British officers who were entering the Indian Army, as well as in the 1920s, some Indian officer cadets. That ceased when India established its own military academy. But after the Second World War, the War Office was principally concerned to ensure that Sandhurst was a source of high quality British officer cadets to supply the needs of the British Army. They also hoped that some overseas cadets might go to Sandhurst, and in that way it would facilitate collaboration and communication between Commonwealth states. But at this point, it's late 1940s, they thought that only white overseas cadets should be admitted, unless the cadets were from countries where British officers were no longer in commanding roles in relation to local forces. But in the course of the late 1940s and the late 1950s, Sandhurst assumes a new role, and that is training a local officer class. And it does so both in relation to cadets from Britain's remaining colonies and from countries that had already attained independence. Now, in the case of cadets from countries that had already attained independence, the Foreign Office and the Commonwealth Relations Office were very keen that Britain should train as many overseas cadets as possible, rather than that those cadets should be trained elsewhere, as indeed many of them were, particularly to be understood in the sort of Cold War context. And indeed, they speak about how Britain's military training establishments could be utilised as a Cold War weapon. The Colonial Office sought places for cadets from the colonies, also because they wanted to sort of promote British models and British connections, but to facilitate the creation of local officer classes to relieve some of the demand for a British officer class. And the upshot was that by the mid-1950s, the authorities at Sandhurst felt that they were overwhelmed with overseas cadets, and that the presence of the overseas cadets was undermining what they understood as their core function, training a high-quality British officer cadet class. And they set ratios on the number of overseas cadets that could be admitted. And they referred to these in very telling terms as the dilution ratio, i.e. that the number of or overseas cadets needed to be kept below a certain level so that their impact in Sandhurst as a whole could be diluted by sort of larger presence of British officer cadets. And you know, this reflected a couple of different things. I mean, one was the their suspicion, and there were some grounds for this, but perhaps there's also a cultural element to it too, that overseas cadets were weaker academically than British cadets, but also because the presence of such large numbers of overseas cadets from very different countries generated tensions at Sandhurst itself. So Sandhurst, you know, shows something different. It shows how British military training could be used within the Cold War context and to offset some of the changes resulting from decolonisation. So effectively, as sort of Britain moved from a situation where it could use, or where the army was kind of symptomatic of British hard power, instead military training became an instrument of British soft power. But it wasn't without cost for the institution, and it generated some resistance within that institution. But remarkably, Sandhurst went on to train overseas cadets through the 70s and the 80s, the Commonwealth and the 90s, and still does today. And the Commonwealth element to those gradually diminished, and the presence of cadets from Gulf states became sort of more significant. But nonetheless, amongst a first generation of overseas Commonwealth cadets who had trained at Sandhurst, who then attained positions of seniority in their own forces, and indeed in some cases as a result of post-colonial military coups, became heads of state, it encouraged a kind of professional connection to Sandhurst. And for example, if we take Ghana, as I said earlier, the first of Britain's African colonies to become independent, Ghana initially sought to access training elsewhere. It didn't want to be tied to Britain. And yet, remarkably, Ghana sent cadets to Britain every year between 1957 and the late 1980s, in part because the British government funded some places for Ghanaian cadets, but also because there was a perception amongst Ghanaian cadets that actually, you know, a Sandhurst training was good for one's career.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. So most recently, I've been turning to look at another institution that isn't featured in my book, but it's one I've been working alongside in tandem, and that's the Church of England and its role and engagement with politics during decolonization and some of the adaptations it made in the context of decolonization. I have an ongoing interest in development and technical assistance, and it's to that that I'm turning sort of after this. I'm currently co-editing a book with another historian of decolonization development, Véronique Dimier, which is on business and development. Longer term, I'm building on this interest in development and technical assistance and the sort of transitional phase from colonialism to after. And I want to focus more on the 1960s and the 1970s and Britain's relations with areas that remain part of the empire at the same time as Britain was delivering aid to places that were newly independent.
Well, it sounds like you have quite a few projects underway. I look forward to reading all of them. Sarah, thank you very much for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to speak with us. Hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Mark.